Welcome to Straight Talk with Carly Lissa Thorne, and I have with me today Dr. Terry A. Gordon, and we're going to be talking about his passion about defibrillators in schools, his book that is No Storm Lasts Forever, and I think a little bit about life, which I think is such an important topic, and various other things. So welcome, Dr. Terry A. Gordon. Which do you prefer?
Nice to be here. Please call me Terry.
I had a feeling I'm going Terry Gordon, yeah. I always like to ask, though, for the first thing I love to ask you, because I always like people to actually share their accolades versus me reading a long, inundated bio of people's accolades, if you will. What actually got you into cardiology?
Well, when I was 7 years old, now this is back in the 1950s, there was a show on TV called Operation Open Heart. And it was a little boy named Gussie who had a hole in his heart. And they showed what he couldn't do physically. And really, he was so limited, he could walk about 10 steps, and then he would have to squat and breathe through pursed lips. And then they actually showed, as I recall, the operation on TV. And then what happened after the operation and how well he did. And I was mesmerized by that. And from that point on, get out of my way, I'm going to be a doctor. So all of my book reports were on the heart. All of the models that I ever put together were not of airplanes. They were of bodies, you know, the invisible or the visible body, the visible woman, the visible dog, the visible eye, the visible heart. And I just, from that point on, wanted to be a cardiologist. So all my book reports were on medicine. And, you know, it was just something I was going to be. I talking about a power of intention, I developed this intention very early in my life.
Now, do you specialize in a certain niche of cardiology, or is your passion just general cardiology?
Well, I trained at the Cleveland Clinic in invasive cardiology, and I also performed electrophysiological studies and put in pacemakers and defibrillators. And early into my career, I was doing, when angioplasty and stenting first came out, I was doing that as well. As our group evolved, I concentrated mostly on invasive cardiology, which, you know, involved doing diagnostic work as well as cardiac catheterizations and pacemakers.
So one of the things I'd love to talk about, I know one of your passions is getting automated external defibrillators, AEDs, in schools. What actually stirred this up for you? And I know you've actually gone on to help get them in schools. So I used to be an EMTD first responder and all that stuff, so I know a lot about defibrillators in general, and I have actually 10 different Western certifications in medicine. And so I would love to find out from you, I know how important they are, what actually got you, you know, actually interested in having them get into schools, and how you've gone about helping to create that.
In the year 2000, I was then president of our local chapter of the American Heart Association. And we had a 15-year-old, his name was Josh Miller, who was playing football one Friday evening in Barberton, Ohio, which is a suburb of Akron. And he ran off the football field and he collapsed. And in front of his teammates, in front of his friends, and sadly in front of his parents, Josh Miller died. He died of a cardiac arrest. Now, kids are not supposed to do that. I had the unfortunate experience to watch the videotape of Josh's death, and it was the most sickening thing, Carly, I've ever seen. It was like watching a movie you'd seen 1,000 times, and you knew exactly how it was going to end, but you were helpless in changing the ultimate outcome. And in that normally boisterous stadium, you could hear a pin drop, except for the wail of his mother. And his father was in the background pacing back and forth like a caged cat. And what transpired is it took a few minutes once he collapsed for them to wave the ambulance that was there over across the field. And so when the ambulance arrived, they got out of the ambulance, they took a defibrillator out and they put it on the gurney, and that's where it stayed the rest of their resuscitation time. They, in their defense, they thought they were dealing with what you would think you'd be dealing with in a football game, a neck injury. So they were stabilizing his neck when, in fact, young Josh was in a cardiac arrest. What happened after that is I made a vow that this wasn't going to happen again in our community. And I suggested to the board of the American Heart Association that we place an AED in every junior high school and high school in our community. Now, everybody said I was crazy, which, by the way, I am. But they, you know, we would have to raise $300,000, and they really didn't think it was something that could be done. And that's all I needed to hear. So went about and we raised $300,000, and we put an AED in every junior and high school in our community. We trained 12 people in each school in CPR, first aid, and the use of AEDs. And we became the first county of its size in our nation to do so. And it was kind of a slow year for the American Heart Association that year. They named me their National Physician of the Year for this effort. And I'll tell you the truth, I thought it was a joke when they called me, because I don't consider myself in that category. But it did, it wasn't a testament, it was a testament to the American Heart Association and what they stand for. It wasn't an accolade for me, at least that's the way I took it. And once we did this, then I thought, well, what about the next county? And the county after that. And I went to D.C. to lobby for this. Now, I was very naive. I went for a meeting on sudden cardiac arrest in kids, and it was a group of parents, actually, who had all lost children to cardiac arrest. And one of the fathers and I took off out of the meeting, and we went up on the hill, and it became very clear very early that we weren't going to get anywhere, because unless we were one of their constituents, they wouldn't even talk to us. So it was on the way back home on the flight, and I was meditating, and I was asking for guidance, and I said, you know, I've got all this energy. Show me what to do. And it popped into my mind how this was going to unfold and who it was I was to approach. And the person I was supposed to approach, Carly, his name is Dave Brennan. He's a gentleman here in town. Didn't know anything about him. Didn't know what political affiliation he was. I just got this vision. I was supposed to talk to him. So I called him that night, asked him if I might be able to come over. He said, well, come on over the next morning. So I went over the next morning. I had this little booklet of pictures of kids who had crossed over from sudden cardiac arrest. And I started sharing with him each of their stories. And about halfway through, he very respectfully leaned forward, closed the book on my hand, and said, Terry, you don't need to convince me of this. Cut to the chase. What do you need? And I took a deep breath, Carly, and I said, I need $5 million to put an AED in every single school in the state of Ohio, to train 5 people in each school, to align them with the local paramedics and 911 service. And he leaned back and thought for a moment and said, okay, here's how we're going to do it. And it unfolded exactly the way I saw it in my vision. It took a couple of years, but the state of Ohio did donate, or a lot, I should say, $5 million in $2.5 million increments. We placed a total of 4,470-some-odd AEDs in schools, trained 5 people, and became the first state in the nation to have a comprehensive program like this. And the proof's in the pudding. We've had at least 20 saves as a result of that. The most recent one was about a month ago. It was a 6-year-old in first grade that was saved by one of the AEDs we placed in the schools. The very day that we completed the Ohio initiative, we were down in Columbus, the state house, and the head of the Senate and House were there. And I received a phone call from Betty Sutton, who was our U.S. Congresswoman at the time, and she congratulated us on the success. And she said, you know, Terry, do you think we could do this on a national level? And I said, no, Congresswoman, I don't think we can. And I remember her, she kind of sighed. She said, oh, really, why not? And I said, because I know we can. And I wasn't being cocky. It was that power of intention that Wayne Dyer talks about. I could already see this program as being. Well, she grabbed the baton from me and bolted. And within 6 months, she had gotten the Josh Miller Hearts Act passed through the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously, only to have it fail to get through the Senate. It was Senator Kennedy was the head of the HELP committee at the time, and he had the brain tumor. And they closed down all of the committee action. So it never passed. The bill ultimately died, and when she had to present it again the following year, which she did, it passed once again unanimously. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton was our proposer in the Senate with Sherrod Brown, who's a senator from Ohio, but it failed to make it through the Senate. Unfortunately, what happened was in the Senate, U.S. Senate, one person can block a bill. And that person happened to be a physician, Dr. Tom Coburn, from, I think, Oklahoma. And his, you know, he liked the bill. He liked what it was about. But his line in the sand was fiscal responsibility. And because this bill would cost about $100 million, he wouldn't let it get through the committee. So it has not gotten through the Senate, although it's passed twice the House. The sad thing, the travesty, quite frankly, is that since the bill first passed the U.S. House of Representatives, over 200 kids have died of a cardiac arrest in our schools. 200 children have died needlessly. And if you walk through the halls of Congress, guess what you see everywhere? 80.
Exactly. I think it's really sad. I think a lot of it is having people like you reach out to, you know, local people within each state. And I think like how you did it, you got someone to come aboard and then you guys helped raise the funds for that state. If you actually started speaking at schools and started going to other states and created kind of like a little bit of a ruckus, if you will, and got other people on that bandwagon as well, then they could go out fundraising for, you know, their city, then work on their state. I think it's one of those things, to me, it's always about paying it forward, the ripple effect. It's not the paying it forward, it's the ripple effect. I mean, Right. They are tied together. That ripple effect is so impactful. It's so important. And it is, you know, as we know, working with senates and governments, it's never easy because they don't want to foot the bill. And so I think doing something like that, I think, would be really empowering, A, to the community, because like when 9/11 happened, tragedy happens, brings people together. I think starting those waves creates community, creates people wanting to get together to create the funds, do something that will save our children. And a part of it is that miseducation that kids, like you said, never would get a heart attack, would never have heart failure. And it does, it happens. It's not just he came off the field and, you know, collapsed out of exhaustion. You know, he really had an episode. So I really think it's amazing that you did that. And blessings for doing that. So what I'd like to... Go ahead.
I was going to say, let me just add one thing. You know, the problem with doing it community by community is there is such resistance to change, first of all. And it's not their job. I mean, these were the things that everyone said. And one county away, you know, there wasn't a person who was championing this. You know, and unfortunately, what has driven most of the initiatives across the country are the parents who have lost their children. It hasn't been the legislators that are spearheading this. It's the parents. So if in Cuyahoga County there hasn't been a child die, there's no interest there. So that's why my thought was, rather than do it on grassroots, which is how ours started, to do it from the top down, you know, federal government. And it should be. I mean, there's just, as you know, AEDs work. When you have somebody that has a cardiac arrest, if you wait for 911, you know, 3 to 5% of those people are going to survive. That's it. If you do CPR, that doubles the chance of survival from 3 to 5% to 6 to 10%. But if you do CPR and add an early shock, and I mean within 2 to 3 minutes, the chance of survival can be upwards of 50 to 75%. So it's a no-brainer. You know, they work. And as you know, no affront to the paramedics, we have the best in the world, but the average response time is 8 to 12 minutes. And every minute someone is in a cardiac arrest, his or her chance of survival drops by 10%. Every minute. So if you wait for the paramedics, chances are that person is going to be dead. Now, an interesting caveat is putting AEDs in police cars. And we ultimately did that in our community as well. Because 80% of the time, police officers respond to medical emergencies such as this. 50% of the time, they get there first, and they can deliver the shock 3.5 minutes quicker than if you wait for the paramedics. And again, that's because there are more police cars out there as opposed to a limited number of paramedics units. But if you get shocked by a cop, your chance of walking out of the hospital unscathed is enhanced 10 times. So it's a no-brainer. It's just a matter of getting these people to appreciate that, you know, we can definitely save lives by getting AEDs everywhere. Schools, high-rise buildings, golf courses, you know, office buildings, shopping malls, everywhere they need to be.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. So I'd like to talk about a couple other things. On your website and other things I've looked at, it calls you the wounded healer. I think everybody in their work has some sort of nickname, and there's always an amazing story behind that. So I'd love to have you share a little bit as to how you came about being called that. I think, you know, all of us have had a past, all of us have had experience unique to our own, obviously, and I think those experiences have two choices, makes us stronger or makes us angry in victim mode. And I think you're a lot like me, that any experiences that you've had, it's only made you stronger and more positive, even though people think, oh, well, you can't be as positive all the time. You can't, you know, do this. And I'm like, I'm human. I have my meltdowns. At the same time, I choose to always be in more in the state of empowerment as often as I can. And when I'm not, I catch myself and do whatever I can to come out of that.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I wasn't referred to that until after I retired from the practice of cardiology, interestingly. But it kind of started before that. And I have to tell you, when people called me that, I was a little uncomfortable because I didn't quite understand what it meant. But when I first graduated from medical school, my wife, Angela, embroidered this picture with the following words on it. It said, treat each of your patients as a loved one. Feel his pain, his loneliness, his fears. You will suspect everything and miss nothing. Like it or not, you will be loved as you are loved. And you know, I look at that every morning when I went in to work. And I had it on my door leaving from my office. And when I first started practicing, though, I felt like I needed not to become emotionally involved with people. Patients, that I could be more efficient if I didn't get emotionally involved. In fact, my mother didn't think I could be a doctor because she thought I was so sensitive, I was too sensitive, that if I ever lost a patient, that I wouldn't be able to make it. And then I realized, as I was practicing medicine, I was missing something. There was something very important missing from the mix. And it turned out it was that emotional involvement, that I had to find a balance where I could be emotionally involved, I could love my patients, and yet also take good care of them. It came from Greek mythology. Chiron, who was the wisest of centaurs, he was in battle, and he was hit with an arrow that had been dipped in Hydra's blood, and he became very ill. And the lifelong anguish that he had experienced along the way sent him out on this journey of discovery. And as he was on this journey, he also realized that there were many other people that were on the same journey. And so in his search for a cure for himself and the healing of himself, he was then better able to help others. And I found that especially after our family, I say tragedy, but I have a better word, and I'll share that with you a little later, that I have been wounded, and you know, you can sympathize with people, but it's totally different than empathizing with people. So it's from your own brokenness that you can help others when they realize that, yes, you have a broken spot as well. So that's where the wounded healer came in, and I feel more comfortable in that. There are a lot of wounded healers, not just doctors. Anyone can be a wounded healer, you know, if you're empathetic and caring and loving, and you're there trying to help others endure their pain, you're a wounded healer.
Well, if you think about it, it's an analogy I use a lot is, would you go to a priest who, you know, some priests can now. However, in the old days, priests could not get married, could not have children. So would you go to a priest who's never been married, has never had children, for advice? Right? So to me, I'd rather go to someone who's had, may not be the exact same experience as I, but has come from some sort of battle or has come through some experience that may be similar to mine. So they can empath, so they can sympathize, so they can help me in a way that someone else may not be able to because they understand from a different level. And obviously our experiences are unique to ourselves. However, if I'm going to work with a client who's had sexual, verbal, physical abuse, or has had, you know, been an early widow, or someone's died of suicide or something, it's good to work with people that have had some sort of similar experience, because I think I use my past as, if I can do it, so can you. And so I think we're all teachers for each other anyway. I learn from my clients all the time. However, I notice the type of clients that I get are people who have had some sort of trauma or abuse or something, because they get that I understand. And I think that's a very powerful tool.
Well, I think there's a distinction too, between curing and healing. And so many physicians that I know, and I'm not being judgmental, it's just a statement, don't get involved with their patients. You know, they don't allow themselves to expose themselves, if you will, to the hurt. And then we then are left to rely on medicines and, you know, the practice of medicine to try to cure people. But what I found late in my career, I might add, is that healing occurs in a totally different place. It doesn't occur in this physical plane. It occurs in a place of much higher consciousness. And I'm not sure that many physicians allow themselves or even know that that place exists. And like I said, I went through most of my career without knowing it. But I think the place of healing is in a place of much higher consciousness than on the physical plane.
Well, what's happening, which is really beautiful, is hospitals now are even having courses of Reiki for nurses, because they're realizing if you give someone Reiki energy prior to surgery, after surgery, they're more relaxed, they need less pain medicine, and they heal faster. And mm-hmm. and it's sad that, and it's both male and female doctors, a little bit more on the male side, because in other words, if they allow themselves to be vulnerable, then they're weak, because of the way men have been raised. And women tend to be more the caretakers, so they may, if their doctors, tend to be a little more empathic or more open or more vulnerable. I wish that we all would realize that in our vulnerability, not only do we grow, but we help other people grow at a different level, and that it isn't a weakness in being vulnerable, it actually is a strength. And I love the fact that there's some more and more hospitals. I mean, if you look at Oriental medicine or Eastern, I call them Eastern modalities, for me, it's beautiful how those hospitals and those clinics really do rely more on the energy of meridians, and they look at various, you know, modalities. They may be looking at flower essences, aromatherapy, acupressure, acupuncture. It's not just, and this is the other thing I teach my clients all the time. However, Western medicine always has a place, so don't poo-poo Western medicine. Right. I wouldn't be alive without it. You break a bone, right. They're going to fix it. You have a heart attack, you're going to be saved by the AED. However, I think Eastern methodologies and principles really do have a plethora of preventative tools and actually helping you coexist with maybe a Western that you have to do because of whatever reason. However, to me, they both serve a purpose.
They do. And in fact, interesting, unfortunately, I've spent a lot of time at the Cleveland Clinic of late with some of my family members. When you get off the elevator at the Cleveland Clinic, you hear Buddhist music. And it's so subtle, most people don't hear it. It's beautiful, though, throughout the whole place. So even places like the Mecca, meaning the Cleveland Clinic, they've come a long way, you know, and there's complementary medicine and acupuncture, Reiki, as you mentioned, they're all integral to healing.
I love that. I love that people are becoming more open-minded. I've studied like 20 Western and 25 plus of Eastern because I've had, let's see, I'm going on 32 surgeries now. And for me, the reason why I studied Western medicine is I wanted to be a self-advocating person that could actually say, I knew what was going on with my body. I knew it was hurting. I knew it was this or it was that. And I wanted to find out everything I could about Eastern modality so that I could help and better my body, my health, my strength, my attitude in getting through the journey that I needed to get through. And so for me, it's so important that people understand that they both have a place. And a lot of it is, you know, faith-based, belief-based, because if you like the placebo effect, right? So if you believe that isotope, that radioactive isotope is going to cure that cancer, it will. No different than if I believe that flower essence on some level will. And it's a really, I love talking about the subject because once you start studying archetypes and people's energy base or whatever, you start to see what people actually align with the different modalities more. So it's a really fascinating art. And I think both are just, to me, the human body, the brain, how we function, how we live is just, it's such an amazing, intricate, fabulous thing. And then also the study of energy, meridians, and arts is all that level is to me as miraculous, and how things happen. Babies that were stillborn all of a sudden put against mama's, you know, heart and breast, and it's starting to breathe. You know, that human need and connection of touch. So it's just such a fabulous subject. So I was actually quite excited to get a chance to talk to you. So something else I'd love to talk about, because, you know, we're talking about you here today, is you've also written a book that's called No Storm Lasts Forever. So first, this is one thing I always love to ask, because there's always a story behind it. What was your inspiration behind the title? Because I have found that the titles always have their own unique story. And then, you know, what is your inspiration behind the actual book? The titles, to me, I've gotten the most fun, amazing stories when I ask people, what was the inspiration behind that title?
Well, you know, I have to back up years and years before that, because I was being prepared for what was ultimately going to happen in our family. And Wayne Dyer, quite frankly, was the one who took me on a different path. No storm lasts forever for me. Means that the sun is always shining someplace. And it's a matter on what you place your focus. So often when tragedy strikes, we get sucked into the abyss and the quagmire, and that's where we stay. And one of the things that I've learned through this experience is that it's okay to focus on the beauty. And when you focus on the beauty, that's when the storm goes away. So no storm lasts forever. Holds a very special place in how I have evolved in looking at circumstances.
Well, one thing I found is with Dr. Wayne Dyer's work is, I don't know if you remember the story about him telling his little girl in the bumps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's a lot of it is giving people a permission to go, hey, this is happening. I always tell people to, first of all, recognize what is happening, love what is happening, attempt to find the lesson in what is happening, and then choose to let it go and move on. And we actually, you know, go through those, if you will, grievance processes. It is, in a weird way, a whole, it's like when someone dies, you go through steps. I think the acceptance of whatever is going on, whether it be someone's passing on, suicide, you know, a terminal diagnosis, whatever that is, even the bumps on his daughter's arm. And, you know, he finally, you know, start talking to her about it and say, you know, love your bumps and talk to your bumps. And, you know, and then she did and, you know, they went away, right? So I think a lot of it is that our society doesn't really allow us to really talk about things. And I think it is because we're so, I guess, conditioned to think that if someone talks about things, one of the, you know, analogies you hear all the time is, well, if you just keep repeating the story, you could, you know, you're going to create more of that story. And I am of the belief that it depends on how you're telling that story. If I'm telling a story from a place of anger, victimhood, it's a very different energy than if I'm using that story to say, look, this has happened to me. I'm going on my whatever surgery tomorrow. If I can still stand up and do an interview from a hospital or, you know, whatever it is, right, you can do this too. So I really think it depends on how we are telling the story. Is our story our identity, or is our story a tool to empower and motivate, inspire, and educate others?
Sure. Well, you know, I was the way I came to Wayne Dyer, I had read one of his books. I think it was Your Erroneous Zones back in the 60s or 70s. And I had this patient that I'd never met before. His name was Art Blair. And I was a very busy cardiologist. My average day was 15, 16 hours. And I'd be in the cath lab doing six or seven heart catheterizations, a couple of angioplasties, put in a pacemaker or two, see 40 people in the hospital, and be over in the office by 1:30 to see another 20 or 30. So I was really, really busy. And I go walking into this guy's room, and the first thing out of his mouth, this is a patient saying to me, whoa, Dr. Gordon, you're killing yourself. And I said, I beg your pardon. He said, you've got this great energy, but it's all fractured, man. You better do something about it, or something very bad is going to happen. And I corrected him. I said, you know, Mr. Blair, I'm the doctor here. I'm here to take care of you, not the other way around. He said, well, all I'm telling you is what I see. So the next time he came back into the hospital, he was having atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular heart rhythm. And he said, you haven't done anything about it yet, have you? And I said, you know, I just don't have the time. I'm just so busy. I'm like this mouse on a wheel. And he said, well, I've got a couple of suggestions. I want you to read a couple of books by Dr. Wayne Dyer. And the books he suggested were Real Magic and Inspiration. And then you also need to learn how to meditate. And I had dabbled with that back in the 60s. Well, I read his books, and they really resonated with me. And I tried calling to get in touch with him. I got as far as his secretary, Maya. And when she answered the phone, I said, this is Dr. Gordon. I'd like to speak with Dr. Dyer, please. She could have cared less. So I never got to talk to him. So a couple of years later, my wife, Angela, and I took a trip to Hawaii. And Angela developed shingles right before we left, and it was a terrible case. I'm not sure how she made it out there, to be honest, but first 3 or 4 days she was in bed sick, and you know, here we are on this trip of a lifetime. We've never been there before. And one morning I was out trying to meditate and couldn't, walking on the beach, and I was just coming back kind of kicking the sand, and guess who I bumped into? Wayne Dyer. And I walked up to him and I said, "Man, you know, I know you're on vacation and I don't want to interrupt you, but I just have to thank you for saving my life." He said, "Really? Tell me about it." And so for 20 minutes, Carly, I was the most important person in the world to this guy. And it came out that he had just had an angioplasty, and I told him I'm a cardiologist. Well, we're now best of friends. So he asked us to come over, and we struck up this conversation and this friendship, and he ultimately invited me to come back and speak at two of his Maui retreats. Little did I know, and this was back in 2002, little did I know, he was placed in my path purposefully. And he was there to set the stage for what I was about to face with a personal tragedy. And that happened about, 7 years later, when our son Tyler, who was in school out in Colorado, was involved in a car accident. He had flipped his car over and over and shattered his neck and was left quadriplegic. And it was within an hour of hearing the news that I was speeding up to the airport in Cleveland trying to get on an overbooked flight so that I could be with my son in time. They were flighting him from Durango, Colorado to Denver. And it was on that flight that that it was the worst 3 hours of my life. And in the midst of that, it became crystal clear how I was going to be able to endure this, because I'll tell you, I didn't think I could do it. And part of that stage was set by my dear, dear friend, Wayne Dyer, who, God love him, he called every day we were out there. We were actually supposed to go on a cruise, his family and our family, together. This was the first time we were all going to get together. And, you know, he was as devastated as we were. But he called every day and implored Tyler to understand that he is so much more than his body. Hard thing for, you know, a 21-year-old kid who's buffed and a fantastic guitarist and worked on cars and rock climb, and all that was lost in a nanosecond. But he set the stage for me. And again, that interaction, that not-so-chance meeting was purposeful. And set me off on this spiritual path that has just been a beautiful journey.
I actually lived in Hawaii for 4 years. I actually just moved back to California. And obviously, depending on where you are in Hawaii and where you go, most people don't realize that there, Jack Canfield also runs a transformational leadership organization. They have, you know, all the transformational leaders come out there. And Oprah and Wayne Dyer and all these people, they all have places either on the Big Island or in Maui. And it's always fascinating if you actually, again, this is being aware, you know, people are so monofocused instead of having that both and mindset, opening our, you know, our view to seeing like you bumping into them on the beach. So when you said that, I kind of laughed because I know they all, you know, hang out there, and I know about the Transformational Leadership Council. So there's a lot of brilliant teachers and minds out there at all times, different times of the year. So yeah, it's beautiful. And a lot of them are just beautiful human beings. They really are. And they will take the time to talk to you. And I think a lot of it is how we approach them too. If we're like, invasive versus, you know, just treating them like another human being and having a conversation, and then they're more than open to actually talking to you and just being themselves, which is, I think, a beautiful thing. I think to me that's the transparency, the authenticity. Now, of course, there are some speakers that will not give you the time of day, and that's apples and oranges, and it is what it is. I think, although, if we're the type of person that is more authentic and awake and, you know, have our hearts open, then we tend, like you said, you attract that. It's a beautiful, brilliant thing. So
was so exciting for me is that once I realized that wasn't a coincidence, that it was purposeful, and that those sorts of things were always out there, I just never noticed them, they started to increase in frequency. I mean, it's unbelievable how things become orchestrated for you. And it's miraculous, you know?
It is. Life is beautiful that way.
It is. It is. From A Course in Miracles, it says, you know, miracles are always there. And I consider that not-so-chance meeting miraculous. But in A Course in Miracles, it says, you know, miracles are always there. It's when they're not there that something is terribly wrong. And once you accept the fact that they are there for you, they come and hit you in the face even more frequently. So it's been a great, wonderful evolution that I'm in the midst of, I guess.
So I would like to talk about, you know, our chance and how, that's one thing I love about the internet. It's like, to me, it's link locally, connect globally. We're all interconnected, and there's always a reason, a rhyme, a reason, whatever you want to call it, as to why we meet people and what that conversation leads to. So one of the things I'd like to talk about is you just recently, and I just recently filmed on a movie that was produced and written by Robin Jay called The Secrets of the Keys. I'm so tied into the keyword. I always want to start with that. So obviously we can't give away exactly what you said, but I would love for you to share what key you just represented, and also a little about why you chose to do, you know, everybody has a reason as to why they do something. So what was your inspiration or motivation to be in the movie, and how do you think this movie will help other people?
Well, I was speaking at a very large hospice group in Cleveland, Ohio, and after I spoke, this gentleman walked up to me and complimented me on, you know, my presentation and said, you know, you really need to meet my daughter. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm married and my wife probably wouldn't appreciate that. And by kidding, but, you know. And he said, no, you really need to meet my daughter because she is involved in a project that is just simply phenomenal. And so Robin and I connected and we became instant friends. You know, I could tell we were on the same page. And she was sharing with me her vision of the secrets of the keys. And, you know, it just was kind of like we were now on a parallel path. Kind of like, you remember the bumper cars at the circuses where you're kind of going along and sometimes you bump into another car and then you veer off. Sometimes you bump into another car and you remain parallel with them. And that's what's happened with Robin and me. The Secret of the Keys is a marvelous, marvelous project that is going to touch the lives of millions and millions and millions of people. The people that she has gotten together to create this masterful movie are just exciting to be around. I was out there, I think, in the beginning of April. To film, and it was just so energizing and so exciting to meet the people, all walks of life from all parts of the globe. My key was the key of gratitude, and it's kind of in a twisted sort of way that gratitude was my key, because you know, most people would think when you're faced with a tragedy, and I use that word again hesitantly, that gratitude would be the last thing that you would feel. But it has turned out to be quite the opposite for us. Our son, I mentioned to you, was involved in a car accident, was left quadriplegic. And what I came to appreciate was that what we had been given was a gift. It wasn't a punishment. We're not bad people. We weren't being punished. It was a gift. And it was a gift from the divine. And that gift, it may not come in the most beautifully wrapped package. And in fact, ours was a pretty ugly package. But it was a gift nonetheless. You know, when you're faced with circumstances that are life-changing, life-altering, you have one of two choices. You can choose to accept the gift and learn every single thing you can from that gift. Or you resist the gift, and you suffer, and you victimize yourself, and you lick your own wounds, and you're sad. And so what I chose for myself and my family has chosen is to be grateful. Now, it's been difficult getting to that place. It's not something you just say, okay, thanks, we're going to go about our way. But it's something that we kind of grew into, each at different paces, I might add. But to me, the gift is I've seen my son grow in ways he never, ever, ever would have grown otherwise. And I believe he is now seeing that as well. And that's, to me, the beauty of this. So in many ways, it's been a very beautiful experience, and people always raise an eyebrow when I say that. But for that, I'm grateful, hence the key of gratitude.
I think a lot of people don't understand is, you're right, at the beginning we're angry, why, you know, why me, all this other stuff. However, when we're in it and we do with the grieving and then, you know, the acceptance and we go through all those different stages, we can actually start to see how we change within the process. And it always boils down to choices. Do we choose to be angry and bitter the rest of our lives, or do we choose to take whatever it is and still live a life where we're happy and care about other people? And at least in my personal experience, is that everything that I've gone through, and I think it, one or two things happen. Either brings people together or it tears people apart. And I think it always boils to that choice. I think for me, it's always about, are we reacting to a situation or are we responding to a situation? So I'm sure you've seen your son grow and your family, you know, come together in ways that you never expected, and him, you know, choosing to be strong and come out of it in his own unique ways. I think watching people go through those different aspects can be a very profound thing. And yes, there are going to be times that it's sad and emotional and it's going to hurt. And that's, you know, a part of it.
You know, Wayne often says, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And that's what happened to me. You know, if I told you I didn't ask why me, I'd be lying to you. You know, and people would come up to me and say, you know, Terry, you don't deserve this. You spent your whole life saving lives and helping people and saving lives of kids. You don't deserve this. And those thoughts did cross my mind. But after I thought about them, Carly, I realized I did deserve this. I did deserve the gift. And our family is worthy of this gift. Because it's only by overcoming such a challenge that you reach a place of higher awareness. In fact, the Kabbalah, which is the ancient mystical text of Judaism, says the very same thing. It says, it's the falls of our life that provide us the energy to propel us onto a higher path. It's the falls of our life. And when life is cushy, it's fun, but you don't do much growing. It's only when you face this sort of adversity. And my belief is, the further into this we go, the more growth that there is to occur, the greater the obstacles we're going to have to face. So, you know, rather than lamenting the crap that comes our way, and rather than trying to avoid it and running away from it, we should embrace it. And we should embrace the obstacles and be grateful for the crap that comes our way. Totally different way of looking at things. I didn't used to do that, I'll be honest with you. And as much unfun as things are here, we're at peace. And that's the most important thing. And I think that's what we're all striving for, is peace. And
yeah, peace is a very interesting thing. I think it really can be a beautiful thing when you can find peace in the middle of a storm. It is quite a transcending thing. I just had cataract surgery last Thursday, and my body chose to think of it as a foreign. When they blast away the cataract, you have micro particles of the old lens that remain in your eye. They're microscopic, and normally, a normal person's body would just, you know, expel them or absorb them. Mine chose to think of it as, you know, an invader was in my body, so it created a whole well of water over my eye, and my eye pressure is really high, and I have to have it reoperated on tomorrow because I need to drain it and aspirate it. And everyone else, and I can't see, I'm totally blind in my right eye right now, so if I cover this eye, I can't see you at all. And everyone else is like, why aren't you freaked out? Why aren't you suing him? Why aren't you panicking? And I'm like, first of all, me yelling at him isn't going to do any good. I knew it wasn't something that he did. I knew it was something else. And so this whole time, even though I have no vision in my right eye and I'm bumping into things that have no, like, perfect, it's like, I can't even explain it, because, you know, you're off balance and you feel like you're walking on the moon and perception is all gone. And, you know, I just been, amazingly calm. People are like, don't understand how calm I'm being. They're mad at me in some way. Like, why am I not pissed that I can't see right now? And I'm like,
but you know, if you go through life with the understanding that everything is in perfect order, there are no accidents, there are no missteps, there are no mistakes. Everything, even your eye, is in perfect order. And that's what most people miss. It's got to be somebody else's fault.
Oh, it's been amazing. I mean, I've had to learn so much patience this past week. And, I mean, you know, I've been, you know, really challenged. And I've just been really calm. And I'm actually kind of almost eerily weirded out that I'm not freaking out that I can't see. I've had bad vision my entire life. My mother had German measles. She was pregnant with me. So I have retinal pigmentation, whatever, all this stuff. But it was just, yeah. So I totally get that about just finding the peace within the storm and everything. So it's a beautiful thing for me.
Go ahead. After you.
No, I was going to say, I would like to end with a couple things. I always like to keep them a certain length so that we're not inundating people. What I would like to end with is, I know you have this beautiful daily information. I'd love for you to share, since we're not doing the Google Hangout where it's video and you have your lower third at this very moment. Mm-hmm. And this might just be a podcast, depending on how this new recording is working. I would like for you to share and spell out, because some people are listening and not can't see the lower third, where people can find you, where they can find your daily affirmation. And also, I know you have a new book, which is called My Heart Will Go On. And because you and I could talk forever, and we'll be talking about, you know, endless conversations. So I don't want to let people not know that, you know, you're at drterrygordon.com, but I'd like you to spell that out and tell them how they can get the daily affirmation. And sure. As of all my people know, I put together an amazing blog post that has everything embedded in it and all your links, and it'll have a little blurb about the movie coming out and all that stuff. But I would like them to know where they can find you.
Well, the website is www.drterrygordon.com. And doctor is just D-R, no period behind it. Terry is T-E-R-R-Y, Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N.com. And I do send out a daily affirmation. I'm also on Facebook and LinkedIn and Google+ and all of those. And on my website, there are a number of blogs and, you know, I am on this journey. And I've been graced with this ability to see things that I've never been able to see before, in ways I've never been able to see before. And that's, if you read the book, my book, No Storm Lasts Forever, nature is a very important part of my healing. And there's a lot of that in the book and on the website. So I hope you'll come and take a look.
Okay, so I have to share this with you because I think you'll appreciate this. You said about nature. I created this graphic and I took a tree and had, you know, wind blowing through it in the limbs. And I said, nature is the most fascinating teacher. Be as flexible as a tree's limb, how a tree flexes and moves. The core of the tree, be as strong and grounded as the core of a tree. And I used, you know, the whole analogy of the tree in nature, how things ebb and flow and move and flex and also at the same time is powerfully strong and everything. So when you said that, I automatically thought of that. So
there's a chapter in my book that I'm walking through the park and there's a shagbark tree. It looks like it's falling apart. And I saw the analogy in it of my son, whose exterior was kind of shattered, but the inner core was just as strong as it could be. So I embrace the same.
Oh, love it. So I want to thank you immensely for taking the time to talk with me and spend some quality time having a beautiful conversation. I look forward to more people understanding why it's important to have automated defibrillators in our schools, because we all, and it shouldn't just be in senior homes, it shouldn't just be in hospitals. I think it's a great idea to have in police cars, because like you said, they always arrive first. It's just, you know, unfortunately, it's just, in my experience, police have always arrived first before any sort of EMT or fire squad or what have you, or even volunteers. I think it's a great thing that you're doing. I look forward to the movie coming out. That'll be wonderful. And the movie, by the way, everybody, is the Secrets of the Keys. And it's got some beautiful wonderful people in it. Brian Tracy, Gloria Loring, John Assaraf, Daniel Brinkley, Michael Beckwith, so many other people. Don Miguel Ruiz. You can find the movie at thekeymovies.com. So T-H-E-K-E-Y movies, M-O-V-I-E-S.com. And I look forward to bringing lots of more information to entertain, inspire, motivate, and educate. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
Namaste.
Namaste.